The Scottish economist and philosopher Adam Smith is most famous for his book, The Wealth of Nations, and he's also one of history's most influential people. But could he also be one of the most misunderstood? Jesse Norman, the British Conservative MP, argues in his new book that Smith's Wealth of Nations is a work of genius, but we misunderstand Smith and his views about inequality and society as a whole, that he wasn't the father of neoliberalism. He's a much more nuanced figure than that. Jesse's book is called Adam Smith, What He Thought and Why It Matters. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to Saturday Extra. Welcome, Jesse.
Hello.
So how did Adam Smith come to be so associated with the idea of blatant self-interest or neoliberalism?
Well, it's a fascinating question. Smith has been taken over by different political causes over the years, and at the moment it's fashionable to depict him as the great prophet of capitalism and the apologist for inequality and a defender of greed and human selfishness. You know, if we had been talking 150 years ago when they were arguing about the free markets opening up free trade and getting rid of international tariff barriers, the time of the Corn Laws and the like in the 1840s, you would have found Smith depicted as the prophet of open trade and free markets. Mm. And sometimes he's taken to be a libertarian laissez-faire economist even today. But none of these caricatures is true. And my book really argues not just that, but that the truth is much more interesting and much more helpful to us as we try to diagnose the difficulties of capitalism today.
We'll go to the core of the truth that you have found about Adam Smith.
So the truth is that Smith's genius is that he is the first person to put markets at the center of political economy. That's a fascinating and important contribution. But precisely because of that, he is not some one-size-fits-all neoliberal theorist. He is someone who thinks very carefully about how markets work and how they fail as well as how they succeed. So the idea that somehow he's a devil take the hindmost is a great mistake. For example, in his system of natural liberty, that is one in which it's very hard for inequality to build up because it doesn't allow primogeniture in which, as it were, great family fortunes are passed down to the firstborn, and it doesn't allow masters to exploit the workers. Indeed, he says that whenever there is a law supporting the interests of the workers against the masters, it ought to be preferred because it levels the playing field. And there's a host of other things. Of course, you know, profits can't build up because he really is a theorist of competition much more than a theorist of free markets. So the reason why this is important is because when we start to think today about how markets go wrong and crony capitalism, it turns out that Smith has a tremendous set of intellectual weapons in his armory, and we can pick those out and deploy them to good effect.
Yeah, I think it's also important to remember the time in which he was writing. It's not like he was setting himself against the social democratic state or the welfare state, because none of that existed. In fact, the alternative to Smith, in a sense, was the old feudalism, wasn't it, Jesse?
Well, in many ways, that's true. It slightly depends how you set up the argument. There was a mercantile view of markets in which states dominated international trade and local markets were dominated by regulation from church or guild or national government. And that's another way of thinking of him. You're absolutely right to anchor him in his time, and part of the joy of the book has been to tell this rattling story about the 18th century, which is full of these marvelous figures like Dr. Johnson and David Hume and Garrick and Edmund Burke and people like that alongside Smith, and that's part of the human interest and fun of the thing. And of course, it's also the time of the First World War, as I think of it. That is the Seven Years' War, which established the British Empire, and the Jacobite rebellions, religious turmoil, all that stuff's really wonderful reading. But it does also flag up that for Smith, what needed to be explained, what was so extraordinary, was how Scotland had gone in a few decades from being a place of famine and great rural poverty in the 1690s to being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, which it was by the end of the 18th century. So it's an amazing transition, and it's well en route to becoming, as it were, the Asian tiger of the 19th century by the time he dies in 1790. Why that happened and how commercial society of the kind we recognize today, in which people, as it were, have an equality between each other and, as he says, live by trading like merchants, how that contrast between commercial society and the feudalism that it replaced, how that takes place is very much a target of his analysis and his reflection.
Let's deal with the most famous quote of Adam Smith's, and that is this notion of the invisible hand of the market. Now, this is often taken by centre-right politicians to mean that there's no government regulation. I think you've got a very different interpretation, Jesse. What did Smith mean by the notion of the invisible hand of the market?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and there's no doubt that the way in which the invisible hand has been interpreted today, that is to say, as standing for the effects by which a market can reach a remarkably equitable and efficient distribution of goods, with there being no central governor, no guiding hand, and no organizing body of institutions. That's an astonishing discovery and an amazing thing to reflect on, and it's had influence across our lives. But Smith has no theory of the invisible hand as such. It occurs precisely once in The Wealth of Nations. So it's just a mistake to think of the invisible hand as being at the core of the theory he enunciates. It's at the core of a theory we attribute to him based on a reading of his work, and we understand that. But it's not his. It's not really his theory. His focus is much more of a rather different kind. He is an abstract theorist, but he's also a concrete theorist, as I've described. And what is fascinating for him is to look at not just markets in the way they generally operate, which is what the invisible hand is getting at, but, as I've said, markets in terms of how they specifically operate and often how they fail. And the one thing he directs us to is the part of Smith that people always forget, which is that markets are embedded in moral society, in norms, in expectations, in traditions, in human practices, and above all, in trust. And his first book of 1759, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is a pioneering work of sociology, and Smith should be accounted the father of sociology just as much as he is the father of economics, that book is all about how those social norms, how those social values come into being. And the amazing thing is how relevant they are in a world of Facebook and Twitter and social media, where everyone is competing with each other to try to establish new values, new norms, new fads and fashions and the rest of it.
Very, very important point. It's Saturday Extra here on RN. Andrew West in for Geraldine. I'm speaking with Jesse Norman, the British Conservative MP. His new book is Adam Smith, What He Thought and Why It Matters. Jesse, let's deal with a couple of things where Smith's apostles today, you think, often get it wrong. What did Smith think of taxes, especially progressive taxes?
Well, it's a very good question. So Smith lays down, in a way that has become canonical ever since, the four great rules of taxation. And broadly speaking, they are that taxes should be easy to collect and fair and efficient and transparent. And that's all good. But he also has a specific conception of taxation, which fits with the picture I described earlier about his system of natural liberty. One of the reasons why large surpluses can't build up in his view is because, in his system, as he sees it, is because they can potentially be taxed, provided these rules are obeyed. And some of the taxes that he contemplates are very, potentially at least, onerous. I mean, the one in particular that has caused a lot of comment over the ages is the idea of a land tax. Now, I don't know many countries in the world in which a land tax, which is after all a cash imposition on an asset owned, would be tolerated or seriously considered in politics. And that gives you a sense that it is a very radical idea. Smith himself was not a radical. He was a small city conservative. He doesn't back any of the great radical causes of the day. And he's very nervous about utopian ideas and fanaticism, as you would expect any good Scotsman to be. But he is very radical in some of the ways he's prepared to think his ideas through. And that taxation idea essentially suggests that it might be possible to levy, not punitive, but certainly reasonable burden of taxation, provided those previous rules of fairness, transparency, efficiency and the like have been respected.
A few years ago, or a couple of years ago in Australia, there was a very interesting study that came out. I think it was called something like Economy of Mates, and it looked at the Australian economy, and it concluded that a lot of the wealthiest people in this country had made their fortunes through basically crony capitalism, that is, industries that rely on a favourable decision from government. What would Smith have made of those sorts of economies, fortunes made essentially out of monopolies that are blessed by government?
Well, of course, Smith would have been extremely hostile to that. It happened a lot in his own day, and it is one of his big three diagnoses of crony capitalism, that you get rent extraction when business interests get too close to government. And so he would have been, and he was, extremely rude and extremely effective in his analysis of why exactly economically and politically and socially that is so toxic. What is fascinating, though, is that there's another sense of the idea of economy of mates, which is really quite Smithian. And if you go back to the idea that I had, described earlier, which is that every transaction we have has a moral dimension and a social and a trust dimension, then you can think in terms of an economy of regard. That is to say, all those transactions which have economic effects, but which we don't think of as being economic transactions, tipping, reciprocity, gifting, social care in the home, many of those things are not economically mediated, but they come out of a sense of regard and esteem and respect for each other, sometimes cued by their actions. And in that wider sense, the idea that social trust and a mate relationship that glues economies together is central to economic activity is a very Smithian idea.
Who gets to claim Smith today? Because I understand Mrs. Thatcher used to carry a copy of The Wealth of Nations in her handbag. But I wonder even whether someone like FDR, who supported the small family farm and the small shopkeeper, I wonder whether he gets to claim Adam Smith as well.
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter is very few politicians can't quote at least three lines of Adam Smith, but almost none have ever actually read a book, or indeed probably more than a part of a chapter of a book of Adam Smith. So one has to take it with a big pinch of salt. FDR, it depends which FDR we're talking about. Are we talking about the, as it were, agrarian populist, or are we talking about the man who created a lot of the state machinery of the 1930s in the American economy? As Jacob Viner, the economist, famously said, an economist must be poor indeed who can't quote selectively to advantage from the Wealth of Nations. And the same has been true of politicians. Mrs. Thatcher sometimes thought to have carried the other book that she's thought to have carried is The Constitution of Liberty by Hayek. And I think that points to the essentially apocryphal nature of all of these stories. Gordon Brown, who was actually born in Adam Smith's birthplace in Kirkcaldy, went through a long period where he couldn't give a speech without referring to the fact that he and Kirkcaldy had been born in the same place, as though they were blood brothers. So I'm afraid the scruples of politicians have never been entirely at their finest when talking about him. And of course, it's also true that if you work in a market economy, or if you attempt to guide a market economy, as many politicians do, you are going to think perforce in terms that Smith lays out in The Wealth of Nations and also in his wider body of thought, because the market economy, for all its weaknesses and strengths, is by far the most efficient and frankly equalizing system that's ever been created for the distribution of goods and services. So you're going to be in Smith's world whether you like it or not. The question is, are you going to be there incautiously, foolishly, and not having thought about him? Why are you going to be there wisely, sagely, and aware of the limitations of the economy because you've been vigorously studying him? And I would like to think my own book as well.
Just before we go, Jesse, I don't know whether it's from left field or right field, but it goes, sure, I guess, to a question of today where conservatives sit in the culture? Because for a long time we've been told that in the 70s the left decided to go on this long march through the cultural institutions, principally the universities and the education system, the arts sector. I wonder whether the triumph of the so-called left in those areas isn't because conservatives at some point in the 70s decided that the high point of achievement was no longer culture, but it was commerce.
Well, that's a very interesting and deep sociological idea. And if one thinks of the 1980s as a period in which Britain and America and other countries rediscovered some of the virtues of free markets, it's also important not to draw the line there. When they did that, they were also focused on what can be done. I'll give you an example. I mean, it was a Conservative government that set up the National Lottery in Britain. And that has been, I would think, by some measure, the most important single sporting and artistic intervention of the last 50 years in Britain, with the possible exception of the following the Arts Council, which was set up by Keynes just after the war. So those are the two big things. One, a liberal labour achievement, the other, a conservative achievement. And I don't think that Britain has stopped prioritising, even under conservative or mixed governments, its artistic and cultural sphere. I don't think conservatives talk enough about culture or about the arts. I say this as a man who sat on the board of several artistic bodies and worked very, very closely with many charities supporting young people in their artistic development. So I don't think we talk enough about it, but I think an awful lot of that work is actually being done.
Terrific to talk to you. Jesse Norman, British Conservative MP. His new book is Adam Smith, What He Thought and Why It Matters. It's published by Alan Lane. Thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra, Jesse.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.